Good evening, and welcome to a special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Bob Oakes. It's graduation time again across the country, with colleges and universities holding their commencement exercises, including Boston University's earlier today. In honor of all the hard work leading up to this important milestone in a young person's life, we thought we'd share with you some of that work, specifically stories written and produced by students from this semester's Advanced Radio Journalism class in the College of Communication here at Boston University. The students were given the following assignment: produce a story based on the theme, Made in Massachusetts. As you might guess, the topics varied widely, ranging from technology to theater to food. In a few minutes, Jennifer Berglund takes us to a legendary diner in Harvard Square. Right now, Molly Connors starts us off with a story about a very special line of fruit preserves.
Every morning, in this noisy kitchen, Daniel Charpentier cooks up some of the most popular fruit preserves in New England. His ingredients include blueberries from Maine, pomegranates from Turkey, and ginger from Australia. But he says it's not just the ingredients that make his preserves special.
I think our product is special because it's made with God in mind. To me, it's something that you can taste.
That's brother Daniel Charpentier, one of about 30 monks who make about 1.5 million jars of fruit preserves every year at the St. Joseph's Abbey in Spencer, near Worcester. The monks here churn out about 30 varieties of preserves. Their bestsellers? Seedless raspberry, strawberry rhubarb, and blueberry. Father Robert Morehouse is director of Trappist Preserves.
Rachel Ray, she did a test of blueberry preserves. This got ranked number one.
Father Robert is also part of the largest Trappist community in the world. Trappists are Catholic priests and brothers that live by the rules established by Saint Benedict in the 6th century. One of those rules, live by the work of your hands. From their medieval beginnings until the 20th century, Trappists usually farmed. Father Robert says that's changed.
You can't run a monastery on the income that you get from a farm anymore. So the Trappist preserves is replacing cows.
Father Robert won't say exactly how much cash Trappist preserves brings in, but he will say that the jelly covers only 40% of the monastery's needs.
Our major expense is health care. We just barely cover health insurance with Trappist preserves. And that has to be done.
So, to make ends meet, the monks also make vestments, the special clothes priests wear during Mass, and they run retreats at their guest house. But because of the economy, the non-jelly businesses are hurting.
Priests don't buy vestments when nobody can put any money in the basket on Sunday. That's the first thing that goes. We've noticed that there's not as many people coming to the guest house because they can't afford to take time off.
In spite of the recession, Father Robert says the Trappists started the year with their best January sales ever. Father Edward Storiti has been a monk here for almost 58 years. He got here before the preserves did. He's responsible for making sure the labels get onto the jars.
The jelly's the best place to work. Everybody loves it. Everybody helps one another. A lot of silence, a lot of camaraderie.
St. Benedict also directed the monks to live in silence and solitude, in prayer and penitence. There is no silence in this kitchen, but Father Edward Storiti says there is solitude and prayer.
I work the labeler. It's an $86,000 machine. I push a button, and they go through 86 a minute, and I pray the rosary. I can get 10 rosaries in the morning.
It all started in 1954, when Brother John Burmans tested out a mint jelly recipe and sent the results down to the monastery's gift shop. It was a hit. For that first year, the monks cooked over a stove. Gradually, they invested in industrial kitchen equipment. Father Robert.
When it's ready to be cooked, the cook who's up on the mezzanine rings a bell, and the product is sucked out of the bottom of the kettle into the cooker. The cooker is a vacuum cooker.
That vacuum cooker had served the monks faithfully for more than 55 years. On the day I visited, it went to vacuum cooker heaven. Father Robert says it'll cost a couple of $100,000 to replace. The monks produce around 3,000 jars of jam each morning, and they say they appreciate the sense of accomplishment that comes from supporting themselves. But in the end, Trappist preserves is a means to an end. It's a way for them to support a lifestyle. Each believes he has been called by God to live a contemplative life of prayer, just as Father Edward Storiti.
I always wanted to give my life in the best way to help others, and I found that the best way to do it is through prayer, because through prayer you can reach the whole world.
Walking around the farm is the only way not to be interrupted.
It's a cool, overcast morning at Allendale Farm as I set out for a walk around its rolling fields and placid ponds with longtime manager John Lee.
Student reporter Susanna Boley.
The farm is a rare thing. Located on the border separating the city of Boston and the town of Brookline, it's an urban working farm. It's also one of the oldest farms in America. The land was first deeded to the Weld family in the 1700s.
It's been in the same family pretty much directly ever since then. And they've managed to hold on to it for pretty much forever in American history.
As we walk, we pass fields that are composted and prepared. But this early in the season, nothing has been planted. Not yet.
So what's the first thing usually to go in?
Lettuce. Lettuce and early greens, mostly spinach, will go in first. And then we'll start putting out perennials. And right after that, peas, beets, carrots, onions. The garlic is already up. We planted it in the fall last year. So things are happening, but the ground is just too cold, too wet, too soft to really work right now. I mean, we had, in the February, most of March was very, very dry, so we were able to get on a lot of these fields early. But the last few rainstorms have really backed up the water system a lot. So we're just waiting. We got greenhouses full of plants ready to go.
While John and the other farmers play their annual waiting game with Mother Nature, elsewhere the farm is bustling with activity. Allendale's farm stand and garden center is already open for the season, selling baked goods, specialty foods, and gardening supplies until the harvest starts in early summer. The nursery and greenhouses are chock full of plants. Spring isn't quiet everywhere on the farm.
Not in the nursery. We're game on.
Helen Glotzer is the farm's nursery manager.
I mean, as you can see in the greenhouse, there's just a load of plants in here that are looking beautiful. And as soon as this cold snap of weather ends, we'll be able to move even more and more of this material out for retail.
Allendale is particularly well situated for retail. They also host other activities, including a summer day camp for kids and a series of gardening workshops. They experiment each year with new programs because what works one year may not work the next.
We get to do some things that some smaller small farms don't get to do. And we also have a gift of pretty incredible location. I mean, we're in a very densely populated area. You and I are standing in Boston right now. If we walked a few feet that way, we'd be in Brookline. We have, as they say, location, 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 right?
Of course, this location, location, location is a double-edged sword. Allendale Farm is the largest swath of open space in either Boston or Brookline. That means it's a highly desirable piece of real estate. Farm manager John Lee says the family that's owned the farm for almost 300 years has no interest in cashing out now.
To have a real estate transaction, you obviously need a willing seller and a willing buyer. And there are lots of willing buyers, but no willing sellers. That's the biggest protection. Other than that, we've made arrangements with the trustees of reservations to protect the Boston end of the farm, and we'll work with Brookline to protect the Brookline end of the farm. But it's, it takes a while to develop the appropriate arrangements and protocols. So as those fall into place, the farm will eventually be entirely protected.
Over the past 5 years, John says, business at Allendale has been growing steadily, helped by an increased interest in eating locally produced foods and buying fruits and vegetables direct from the source. And he stresses that the farm has managed to keep out of debt, something that has sunk many farms in the past. But farming is still a precarious business, even in the best of economic times. At one point, he describes it as a mean, nasty, humble, difficult, and unpredictable way of life. And he's only half joking. He works long hours and now in his 60s, says he sometimes regrets not being able to take more time off. But ultimately, there's no place he'd rather be. As we walk past a row of beehives up a ridge above the farm standing greenhouses and look back over the fields, it's easy to understand why.
You wouldn't know you were in the city of Boston, would you? Just spring wildflowers are out. This is a beautiful place. I am constantly in awe of the beauty of this farm.
Leo's place is the oldest diner in Harvard Square.
Student reporter Jennifer Berglund.
It's a landmark in an institution that some people in Cambridge say is almost as important as the university itself. You can't miss it, even from far away. Its windows are painted with a giant hamburger and fries looming over a plate of hash browns and eggs. It's the afternoon in Harvard Square, and the rush is over. Richie Bezjan is working the grill. He and his brother bought it from the original Leo 26 years ago.
It's been a blessing to be here and serve the community and serve good food, fresh food, simple food, affordable food, homemade food, and we continue to do so.
Natalie Biddle has worked at Leo's for 11 years. It started as a job to support her through college. But even after getting her degree in graphic design, she'd still rather work here.
When you're used to spending a lot of time with people and you're used to a fast kind of pace environment and you're used to laughing and joking with customers and meeting interesting characters, it gets very boring to sit over numbers.
Over the years, Leo's has grown a solid base of regulars with a deep loyalty usually reserved for family. Richie calls his diner Cheers Without the Alcohol. Every day, the meter maid comes in for coffee and breakfast. On most days, Peter Wolf, the Jay Giles Band frontman, comes in for his eggs and home fries. His star from the Walk of Fame rests in the corner.
Being a musician and sort of having my breakfast at 3 p.m. in the afternoon, it was hard for me to find a place that could cater to such needs. And I like a lot of the characters. There's the postmen, the mailmen, the street people, the different professors, the writers. There's a collection of the fool's parade that come in and out of here, myself included.
Sometimes, loyal regulars have risked life and limb for the breakfast and soups at Leo's. One story sticks out in Richie's memory.
I had this customer who used to come in all the time, then we did not see him for a long time. Next thing I know, he was with a roller, walking in with his hospital bed. He took off from Mount Auburn Hospital, where we were staying at. He came here to have soup. So I said, aren't you supposed to be, in the hospital? He says, screw it. They don't give you any good food, so I thought I'd come here.
A homeless man named Ed is another part of the Leo's Place family. He's been hanging around Leo's since before Richie and his brother bought the place. Every morning, he waits outside the door to help set up the restaurant. One day, he left the square. It was the first time he'd left in 30 years, and he got disoriented.
They ended up taking him to a hospital because what's funny is that they had them call us.
Natalie answered the phone when he called.
And we hadn't seen him in 3 days, so we were really worried at this point. So we get this phone call, and he goes, yeah, Natalie, it's Ed. Tell Richie to come and get me. So I'm asking him where he is, and he just said, at the place. He needs to come get me at the place. So, like, if there's anybody around you, please put them on the phone. And we get this wonderful nurse that gets on the phone, and she goes, Leo's Place, are you some type of counseling service? I'm like, no, we're just a diner in Harvard Square. And he's one of our people.
Today, Ed is back in the square. He hasn't left since. While flipping burgers and seasoning his famous soups, Richie has seen the dramatic metamorphosis of Harvard Square. In the last 10 years, countless landmarks like the Wurst House and Orson Welles Cinema have been driven out by rising rents and increasing pressure from corporate chains like 7-Eleven and Dunkin' Donuts.
The aim is to remind you of home when you come here. Rather you just have an egg sandwich, I want you to remember your parents. Just a tuna melt, maybe you remember your grandparents. Because let's face it, nobody's from Harvard Square here. Everybody's from all over the world,
Leo's is a place tossed among an ever-changing environment, but somehow it's managed to retain its essence. That's what creates the mystique that's preserved it all these years. The inside is simple. It's stayed the same since its beginnings. So have the friendly faces behind the counter. Its philosophy? Good food at a reasonable price, with what Peter Wolf calls no frills and no jive. It's just like any hometown diner, but with the personalities you can only find in the square.
This is WBUR. I'm Bob Oakes. You're listening to a special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas, featuring stories written and produced by students from this semester's Advanced Radio Journalism class in the College of Communication. We just heard reports from Jennifer Berglund, Susanna Boley, and Molly Connors. Our next three stories following tonight's Made in Massachusetts theme relate to music. Susanna Boley will tell us about a new way of sorting through music online. Jean Ami has a story about a man who plays a rather unusual instrument. And right now, Ben Kyle introduces us to a different kind of rap artist.
It's so mad, I'm a rap addict. I got a bad habit of bad traffic, but he back at it.
That's Nelson Zanz, a hip-hop rapper from Brookline. He's done concerts all across America. He's just released a 5-song CD, and he's working on his first full-length album. He's also an observant Hasidic Jew who keeps the traditional restrictions of Orthodox Jewry, like following kosher laws and not working on Saturday. Yeah, you know who it be, yo, the kid from the beam rolling in on the D-Lo. Zan follows the teachings of the Lubavitch Hasidic Community, an international Jewish outreach organization known for their spirituality and compassion towards other Jews.
Overall, my main angle in this whole music business is a spiritual one, where I'm taking my cues from the teachings of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and he was very adamant and vocal about crazy kids like me who become observant at a later date in life, that they shouldn't abandon their talents from their, you know, secular lifestyle, and that they should try to harness them to make some sort of positive impact in the world.
Zand is 27. He was raised in a somewhat liberal Jewish home in Brookline. Like Matisyahu Miller, another Jewish rap phenomenon who became popular a few years ago, Zan rediscovered his Judaism in his 20s, but his musical passions were sparked years earlier.
I only started rapping from hanging out in, you know, neighborhoods very far, so to speak, from the synagogue. I learned to rap through hanging out with non-Jews and listening to non-Jewish rappers.
So, Zan says, he combined his passions, producing hip-hop with the Jewish message that the world can understand and enjoy. Jared Stevater is a longtime friend and fan of Zan's.
As far as, like, people being able to relate, I mean, it's not going to be hard for them to relate to his lyrics, and I don't think it takes anything away that he's not swearing and not talking about, you know what I mean, this and that, and not on all that gangster rap scenario stuff. But, I mean, it's going to be well-received regardless. It has been so far.
Zan says he has no trouble reaching out to non-Jewish audiences.
I was blown away by the level of interest that people were showing. Remember one time in New Orleans, I'd started selling my CDs at that point, and in New Orleans I sold over 100 copies just myself, and I think it was probably 90% non-Jewish people who were buying the music, which was encouraging because I don't want it to just be music for Jewish people.
Zan says it's important that his music be taken on its own merit, not on the merit of its Jewishness. Nonetheless, the Jewish influence in his music is sometimes obvious. On this track called I, traditional Jewish singing is remixed into a hip-hop song. One Jewish fan, Yaakov Salzberg, says that it's the Jewish themes which make the music powerful.
Especially now when hip-hop is really at its top game, and you see a lot of new artists coming out with hip-hop, it makes a lot of sense that we'd be wanting to fuse that with Jewish music, and I think it could definitely take off. He likes to take very strong thematic elements of Judaism, and he likes to bring those out since they're very powerful themes that really get people feeling, not just thinking.
But how does a traditional Jew live in the world of hip-hop, where drugs, sex, and violence are the norm? Zan says his career goal is to lift up the rap world.
It's clear as day, or dark as night even, what goes on in hip-hop. A lot of people are glorifying very horrific lifestyles that I actually have a fair amount of personal experience with. So I view this as not only something that I'm doing because I enjoy it. I view it as a very important mission that needs to be accomplished, whether I do it or somebody else does. Because I personally would have needed someone like me back, 10 years ago. It might have saved me some trouble.
Zan's website, kosherhiphop.com, went online in April. Hey, yo, I'm trying to make progress, so let me not digress. To not come to sin, pretend your ear, mouth, and eye list. The livest, the Lubavitch element up in your settlement. Everything is heaven sent to feel the stem is evident. I represent the hesitant.
Here's student reporter Jean Ami.
It's Saturday afternoon at Mount St. Joseph Academy in Brighton, home to Boston Coltisari Music School. Steve Brown is finishing his weekly class on the boron, the Irish drum. For his next lesson, Brown takes out about a half dozen pairs of handcrafted bones. He whittled the bones down from the shin bones of cows to make smooth, curved instruments. When he clacks them together, they make a distinctive sound.
So if I'm doing the double tap, it's in two, one and two and three and four and one and two.
The bones are played in pairs, held on either side of your middle finger on your dominant hand. One swings freely into the other.
So you have to push one down, and then you allow the other one to move. And if you snap your wrist and allow momentum to take the bone and knock it into the other one, it'll sound like this. And that's the tap.
He learned how to play 30 years ago from Percy Danforth, a legendary bones player who inspired a bones playing renaissance decades ago.
So when Percy Danforth taught me how to play the bones, he says that there are two elements to playing the bones, the tap and the rattle. And it wasn't years later, after I was really paying a lot of attention to Irish bone players, that I began to see there was something else going on. And what the something else that I call is the double tap. So it's...
Brown's full-time job is a vocational rehabilitation counselor. But on the weekends, he makes, plays, and teaches others how to play the bones, a simple instrument with an odd place in Irish music.
Percussion instruments in particular have a kind of a questionable history in a way. You know, there's not been like a formal school or a formal role, if you would, for percussion instruments. But there just are not that many people that take the bones too seriously. If there is a hierarchy of instruments with things like the pipes and the harp and the fiddle up at the top, you know, you'd have the percussion instruments would definitely be down the bottom, in terms of, just the way people look at them.
He takes great care in making the instrument he loves to play.
Do you see that, Sean? Do you see that kind of white line there? You see a little one right there?
Right.
That's the marrow mark. That's where I brought the bone down totally to where the marrow was and made it consistently flat along that line.
The bones get delivered about 50 at a time from a professional bone cleaning company. It may seem like Brown gets someone else to do the hard work, but really cleaning the bones is only the beginning. He cuts them down and sands them to the best shape and thickness for optimal bone playing. Brown is holding a pair of bones that are about 6 inches long and slightly curved.
You don't want it real, real thick. So it takes a
long time.
So
it's naturally curved like this?
Yeah, it's naturally curved here.
This
piece and this piece is naturally curved. Now, the variation in the contour of it, it's partly, part of it is me wanting it to be this thickness, cutting it to that thickness. And part of it is how much the cow, because if I could make them totally consistent so that they were, like wood, see? Wood is very easy to make, very symmetrical, And bone is very hard to make symmetrical. With wood, you get this big piece of wood, you can cut it down, you can measure it, you can make it exactly the way you want. With bone, you're dealing with what the original shape of it is. Like they say about sculpting, is that you're taking the material away to reveal what it is that you see. And bone is, making bones is like that.
The tradition of Irish music doesn't end with Brown's music classes. Anyone can join the open session on Monday nights at the Greenbrier Pub in Brighton.
The nice thing about the bones is that they can be really different, but you have to be really careful with them too, because they can really draw attention away from the music and away from the other musicians too.
A pair of Steve Brown's bones will set you back $30. Bring your pair to the Greenbrier on Monday nights.
Student reporter Susanna Boley has our next story.
There's a lot of music out there, so much that you can feel like you're drowning in MP3 files. In theory, you can find virtually any recording somewhere online. The problem is navigating through the vast ocean of sound files to find what you like. A small company in Somerville thinks they've got an answer. They're called the Echo Nest, and at the heart of their solution is a mysterious entity known as the musical brain.
To make an analogy, think about what a DJ does.
That's Tristan Jehan, one of the brains behind the musical brain.
DJs, they listen to a lot of music, they have a perception, understanding of music, and they read a lot about what's going on and who are the new artists out there and who's doing what, and so they understand also the audience, like, and they put it all together in building playlists, in providing to an audience things that they're going to like.
And that, in a nutshell, is what the musical brain does, but automatically and on a much larger scale. Let's rewind a little to about 5 years ago. That's when Tristan and his colleague Brian Whitman were graduate students at MIT's Media Lab. They were studying machine listening and music comprehension, basically trying to teach computers to listen to and understand music. But they approached it in very different ways. Tristan looked at the music's physical properties.
So trying to understand a piece of music and all its complexities in terms of rhythms and harmonies and timbres.
While Brian looked at the context surrounding the music, focusing on people's reactions when they listened to it, he asked questions like,
can we understand music by what people were talking about, by observing how people interacted with music, either through what they were saying or reading a record review automatically, all this stuff, and then tying it somehow to the actual audio? Can you say, you know, what does angular sound like in a record group, for example, or, you know, what does funky jazz look like? Can you predict this automatically, this kind of stuff?
While they were at MIT, the two would often meet to drink espresso and argue about music and how best to analyze and understand it.
We would basically fight about the right way to do it, because I would come from the signal angle and I would say, well, the music is what you have in the CD and it's how you perceive it and listen to it. And it's all in the actual signal. And Brian would say, well, no, it doesn't really matter. It's what people, how they respond to the music and what they think of the music and how they communicate it.
Many arguments and cups of coffee later, Tristan and Brian realized that they were both right. The best way to understand music was to analyze both the signal and the critical context around it. Thus, the Echo Nest was born.
The musical brain, we didn't call it that at the time. We just called it, well, we called it the Echo Nest, right? That was our thing we were doing. We were building this system. It's a purely automated way of getting both objectively acoustic information and then the really subjective descriptive information and pulling it together.
But what can the musical brain do with all this information? As it turns out, just about anything. So, say you want to insert the sound of a cowbell into your favorite song. For instance, the Blue Danube Waltz by Johann Strauss. You can do that with an application called More Cowbell DJ. And you can even add an exhortation or two by Christopher Walken for good measure.
Don't fear the reaper.
You can also make your own remixes using the Remix app. With just a few clicks of a mouse, you can change Madonna's dance classic, Hung Up, into a waltz in three-quarter time, simply by removing every fourth beat. But the musical brain does a lot more than parlor tricks. One thing it does really, really well is find and recommend music. Right now, the way most music is recommended online is with the familiar, if you like artist X, you might also like artist Y formula. That's what's known as collaborative filtering. You see it on sites like Amazon and iTunes. And this type of recommender can work okay, at least when it comes to music that's already well known. But as Brian Whitman explains, that's a big weakness.
The problem with that data is that you're missing new stuff. Right? So a new artist shows up, nobody has heard them yet, there's no data about that, right? You can't predict a recommendation against something that no one has listened to yet using those models.
This creates a feedback loop where popular artists become even more popular, and those who are unknown, well, they stay unknown.
This is a huge problem for us as musicians and fans of music. You know, if you're missing out on a totally new artist that might be awesome and you might love them simply because you don't have data in your system about usage, that's really gross and bad. And if all you had was a collaborative filtering system, you know, there'd be less and less music in the world as time goes on if there was no other way for you to discover music.
But the musical brain doesn't have that problem. Tristan's program can analyze any piece of music in seconds, whether it's been heard before or not. And once the music's gotten around a bit, Brian's web crawling programs scour the internet, gathering and analyzing what's being said about it, no matter how obscure the source. So the musical brain can give search results and recommendations that might actually clue you into music that's new. But don't expect to see an Echo Nest online music store or a musicalbrain.fm. These guys aren't looking to build the next wave of musical applications themselves. They want to be the brain behind these applications. They plan to let independent developers use the musical brain to build new music applications, online music stores, or even just the next More Cowbell DJ. If all goes to plan, the musical brain will soon guide you through the cluttered world of digital music so you can find new music you actually like. And if you want to add breakbeats to the Beatles' Here Comes the Sun along the way, so much the better.
That story from student reporter Susanna Boley. Before that, we heard from Jean Ami and Ben Kyle. This is WBUR. I'm Bob Oakes with a special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas, featuring stories written and produced by students from this semester's Advanced Radio Journalism class in the College of Communication. Tonight's theme is Made in Massachusetts. A little later in this next segment, we'll hear reports from students Johannes Kern and Eric Schwartz. But first we go to the theater with student reporter Nick Campos.
In the midst of building a set for the world premiere of David Grimm's Two Men of Florence at the Huntington Theater, artistic associate and director Bevan O'Gara says making a living as a playwright isn't easy anywhere.
Like any other profession in theater, you have to have a day job. There is a sense that this is not how you're going to make your bread and butter. Even the very successful actors and playwrights do have other means of making money. You know, this is their passion, this is what they want to do, but they find other ways of sustaining themselves.
But O'Gara says a change in Boston's artistic attitudes is now creating a greater sense of confidence in new work and the people trying to produce it.
Boston used to be the place where we tried out things before New York. It was the tryout town, and that's no longer the case. And I think that there is that sense of we saw it first here, that the audience really wants to be engaged, and they want to see the first production of Glass Menagerie or Death of a Salesman, the next great American play. And I feel that there's been a lot more people choosing to stay, that there's a lot more young people who want to make this their theater home.
The Huntington Theater has made a large contribution to the recent growth. Their fellowship program takes on local writers every 2 years and helps them develop original plays. Then they're read on stage before a live audience. Full-scale productions often follow.
Close the window, please.
Close the window. I need to hear so that I can teach.
Said Veronica.
Lydia Diamond is a fellow at the Huntington and a professor of playwriting at Boston University. Her full-length play Stickfly will open at the Huntington next season. She says Boston is one of many cities highlighting new work.
Across the country, I think there's a new works movement, and I think that as we all become more sophisticated, the cities do grow around that. And so that makes a lot of sense to me, that Boston would evolve, because it certainly does have a nice base of very talented artists who are very dedicated.
The Boston Playwrights Theater dedicates its entire mission to new work. It has its own fellowship program where graduate-level writers develop both one-act and full-length plays, culminating in a workshop with professional actors and directors. Any non-fellow who wishes to use the theater must be developing original work.
I did it!
Congratulations!
You made it!
You really did!
Ginger Lazarus is a local playwright and Boston Playwrights Fellow. She recently showcased two original short plays at the Boston Playwrights Theater. She says it's undeniably difficult for any aspiring playwright to find exposure for their work.
For new plays, I think it's hard. It's a tough outlook for new plays in Boston. There are a few theaters that do productions of new plays by local playwrights. Huntington is probably the most visible, but the slots, especially for getting full productions of new plays, are very limited.
Michael Dorval is an actor and stand-up comedian. He workshopped his one-man show at the Boston Playwrights Theater. He feels it's no surprise that Boston could be a growing haven for artists like him.
Boston is kind of a city that has a lot more diversity than it gets credit for, and I think it's because there's so many schools here, and people really do come from so many different places in the country and in the world here to learn, and that creates a perfect audience for new art, because they're hungry for information, their minds are more open than in a lot of other places.
In the end, whether or not Boston continues to develop as a theatrical center, the Huntington's Bevan O'Gara says success still consists of equal parts luck, courage, perseverance, and ingenuity.
There is a huge amount of being in the right place at the right time and speaking to the right person, having the right connections, but I think all of that can only get you so far, and that really the hard work and the passion is what actually ultimately will make you succeed.
That report from student Nick Campos. Now we hear from student reporter Johannes Hearn.
For 125 years, the North Bennett Street School in Boston's North End has helped newcomers master various trades. Inside the red brick building at the corner of Salem and North Bennett Streets, you can smell glue and varnish, or feel the touch of wood and metal. Students at the school learn to build furniture, make jewelry, restore old books, or tune pianos.
I can do that in my sleep.
Matt Quinlan spent a year learning how to tune pianos before learning how to fully rebuild them.
My dream is to open up my own rebuilding shop, but I think tuning is the reality of most of the work.
Andy Reach is working on rebuilding a 90-year-old grand piano, a Steinway Model L. Most of the 7,000 moving parts needed to be changed.
When we first got it, it was a junker. It was worth nothing. It was a case, and the soundboard was cracked and stained and old, and the strings were rusted. The pin block had no torque. The tuning pins wouldn't hold a tune.
This morning, Andy and his team took a big spruce board from a tiny climate-controlled room. They then inserted the board into the piano's frame. Now they're waiting for the smelly white glue to dry.
All we're keeping is the shell of the old instrument. All the parts are brand new or refurbished to be like new.
When the students are done, the piece of wood will sit underneath the piano strings and resonate with them, giving the piano its tone. It's the soundboard.
You know, I guess we are kind of building a North Bennett Street School piano with the label Steinway on it. Let's see, we got the rebuilding done for $22,000 is how much the customer pays, and they could sell that for probably $30 to $40, depending on how good the case looks when we're done.
Compare that to the $55,000 to $65,000 for a brand new Steinway Model L. But is there a difference in sound? David Betts has been teaching piano rebuilding at the North Bennett Street School for over 30 years.
I'm not sure if I could tell you the one that we did compared to the one Steinway rebuilt, or perhaps even to what a brand new one would sound like.
Student reporter Eric Schwartz.
The old North Church bell rings as a steady stream of people file in and out of the 286-year-old building. Many pause to admire the bell ringing in its famous steeple. On April 18, 1775, that steeple housed two lanterns placed to warn that the British were coming by sea. In a garden next to the main building, plaques dedicated to the famous and wealthy line the walls. One plaque, though, tells another story of the historic steeple.
Here on September 13th, 1757, John Childs, who had given public notice of his intention to fly from the steeple of Dr. Cutler's church, performed it to the satisfaction of a great number of spectators.
I wish I could have been there in the past to see him fly, because I've always wanted to fly.
I think it's really interesting. It sounds really cool. It's one of those like great stories from Boston history, and Boston has so many. I feel like I'm always learning them every day.
John Childs made himself memorable.
He attracted attention by putting in a very boastful ad in the paper. A lot of people showed up because they couldn't figure out what flying meant.
Peter Benish is a historian specializing in the folklife of early New England. He's written several articles about the traveling entertainers of the colonial period, including John Childs. But Benish says, despite the plaque immortalizing Childs' deeds, very little is known about him.
We have no idea who he was. He was probably an Englishman. He obviously came from England because his advertisement said he had flown off the monument by the Duke of Cumberland's desire. So that, you know, there's an English context to him, and he comes out of England. He's very probably either an English or some other kind of sailor that knew how to handle ropes.
Knowing how to handle ropes was probably essential to Childs' trick. First, he climbed the 190 feet to the top of the church steeple.
He attached a rope to the top of the steeple, and then either had a partner or had someone else put the other end of the rope about 700 feet away near the waterfront. Then he put on what you might call a vest. And the vest was composed of a plaque of wood with a groove running down the middle. He tied this onto himself, and then he put that on the rope, and then he gave himself a shove.
To the crowd gathered around the church, especially those too far away to see the rope, John Childs appeared to fly.
He stayed in the air about 18 or 19 seconds.
And then landed, safely if not gracefully. Actually, the method of flying John Childs used is unclear because all the information about what he did is secondhand. The rope trick is the accepted theory because others did it that way, particularly in Europe. In Boston, Childs was only a brief sensation.
He must have done it about four times. I think he did it twice on the first day, and then he came back and the next day and he did it two more times. One time, I think he took a couple of pistols with him, and he snapped one, and the other one didn't go off.
One of the reasons the flight of John Childs is remembered is because of the rarity of that kind of entertainment in the city.
He was one of very few acrobats who made it to Boston. They really spent their time elsewhere because Boston discouraged them.
Today, Boston seems proud of this quirky moment in its history.
I think it's a cool part of history that people should know about.
Tourists and locals are sometimes surprised that there is a commemoration of the flight of John Childs, but both are usually quite delighted. It's easy to imagine that John Childs would be thrilled that something of his brief show lives on in the memory of Boston, a feat that, in some eyes, may even outshine Paul Revere's famous ride.
One if by land and two if by sea, and Paul on the opposite shore would be ready to ride, and right by his side a pepperoni pizza. Okay, let's call the old North End. If Paul Revere could see it now, he would take all his friends. Ciao!
Student reporter Eric Schwartz. Before that, we heard from students Johannes Hearn and Nick Campos. This is WBUR. I'm Bob Oakes with a special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas, featuring stories written and produced by students from this semester's Advanced Radio Journalism class in the College of Communication. In our final segment of the program, in which students were asked to explore the theme Made in Massachusetts, we take a look at one of the Bay State's most unique creations. Student reporter Beth Foster has the story.
Try this. Park your car.
Your car.
Say it the way you would say it.
Park your car.
Park your car?
The Boston accent is known by the infamous line, park the car and have it yard. But most Bostonians can tell the difference between a genuine accent and someone attempting the local lexicon. So what's behind this regional dialect? Speech specialist Susan Fletcher gives us some characteristics.
One of the big things you'll hear with a Boston accent is the omission of the R sound, and then also a substitution of an A sound for an A sound. We substitute an ER sound, for just an sound, and that looks like, when you're transcribing it, an upside-down E. It's also called the schwa. So what they're doing is, instead of saying Asia, they're saying Azure, and they'll put an R on the end. On the other side, if it has an R on the end, like sister, they're saying sista. Bostonians tend to have a little bit more, it's called assimilation nasality, where the sound gets a little bit like this. Not quite like banana, you know, but a little bit of that nasality comes in.
The accent is a testament to the diversity and history of Boston. Fletcher says different neighborhoods within the city and surrounding areas all have their special quirks.
There are several Boston accents. Let me start with that, because, of course, people in the North End have a different accent from what we think of as a Harvard or a Brahmin accent, which is different from maybe a Dorchester accent. So we've got a big mix because Boston, as you know, was a landing ground for people from other cultures, and we've got little, you know, neighborhoods of accents, and people grow up with whatever their accent is in the neighborhood and what they learn from their peers and from their their parents and their family.
Fletcher helps people decrease the strength of their accent for professional purposes. The accent is one born out of tradition and personal relations. It's a pretty good indicator of how someone grew up.
What we're trying to do is change their habits, the habits they learned through who they grew up around, their parents, their siblings, their neighborhood, their teachers, you know, whoever it is they're around, what they learn to habitually say and get it into a new habit of actually saying the R that they know is there when they spell it and when they see it, and then to slow down and actually put that R back in.
Megan Murphy is a Boston University student and Massachusetts native. She grew up in Woburn and had to come to terms with her accent.
I used to try to hide it a little bit because I think I was sick of being asked to say Pak the Ka. And I really, sometimes people couldn't understand me for certain words. And as an English major, I remember specifically sophomore year of college, I was in a Shakespeare class. And every word at the end, I had to read something out loud, and every word ended in ah. It was words like here, there, everywhere. And I was just, I'm nervous, so when I'm nervous, I can't hide it. I can't try to. And then I remember just hearing snickering and laughing and stuff. So I was like, oh, I gotta hide it now.
She now holds immense pride for the accent because of its individuality and hometown feel.
Now I'm more proud of it. I wouldn't try to change it. Kind of a big part of me, so I don't think I should change it. If I'm hiding it or trying to hide it, then I'm not really being genuine, and I'd rather just be myself.
But for people outside of Boston, the local lingo is often the brunt of jokes. For example, here's a clip from Saturday Night Live starring Jimmy Fallon and the famous Sully and Denise Boston Teens sketch.
This is Pat Sullivan coming at you from Fenway Park. I'm here with my girl Denise.
Call me Zazu!
It's opening day, my favorite day of the year. I can feel it, Zazu. The socks are going all the way this year. Gita's in the crapper.
No man's there!
But Bostonians can see how it can cause laughter.
It's funny. I mean, I can laugh at it because we do that.
Movies that incorporate the accent sometimes come under fire. Ben Affleck and Matt Damon use the accent accurately in Good Will Hunting, but only because they're from the Boston area. Many true Bostonians are critical of a character trying to achieve the Boston accent. Helium.com contributing writer A.J. Grape has studied the portrayal of the Boston accent in films.
They go and find a strong accent in the media, especially in movies. And we have actors who are New Englanders that is, they're superb at the accent, but they're local, and that's fine. And when someone from out of town comes in, even if they're a phenomenal actor, they'll overpronunciate and really put a real screw into the language. I think we hold it sacred. And when someone messes it up, it's noticeable.
BU student Megan Murphy says Bostonians will always regard their accent as a true entity of the city they love.
I think we should keep it alive. I mean, it's ours. It's our accent. It shows where you're from. I think that's. I think we need that. You know, why do you want to be the same?
Student Beth Foster filed that report.
I'm from Boston, hey, and I'm proud to say I love the way we talk. It's a certain flair that we all share like neighbors on one block. Instead of park and park, it's not art, it's art. And my friend Mark is Mark. In the summer, oh, we love to go to the party in the park. I said party.
That concludes tonight's special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas, featuring stories written and produced by students from this semester's Advanced Radio Journalism class in the College of Communication. Our student contributors were, in order of appearance, Molly Connors, Susanna Boley, Jennifer Berglund, Ben Kyle, Jean Ami, Nick Campos, Johannes Hearn, Eric Schwartz, and Beth Foster. Thanks to Boston University Associate Professor Ann Donahue, who helped edit their stories. Party in the Park was written and performed by Johnny the K. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Matt Largie, with help from Mike Toda and Michael Garth. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Bob Oakes, and congratulations to all the graduates out there, and thanks for joining us this evening.